RCR with Paul Brennan. Reality Check Radio.
Tony Gosling is an independent journalist from the UK, a former BBC reporter, now investigative journalist. You can listen to him on Not the BC FM Politics Show, which is on Apple Podcasts. And that broadcasts from Bristol in the UK. Tony also has a connection to New Zealand. He was locked down here during COVID. Tony, welcome to our radio station. Thanks for beaming in.
Yeah, lovely. Lovely to be with you. Thanks for asking me.
Okay, so I'm curious. You were locked down in New Zealand. What, you were trying to get back and the lockdowns happened and you couldn't travel? Is that what happened?
Yep. Eventually we got back via Qatar Airways. But obviously it's not the worst place in the world to be locked down. It's our winter here in the UK and summer there. So, yeah, it was brilliant, actually. No problem at all. It was very expensive getting back. But, you know, I'm a regular visitor to New Zealand because my parents were living there up until a couple of years ago quite regularly, and they had their own place. So most years we try and get out there for usually 6 weeks or so. Very familiar with it. Lovely country.
Well, thank you for saying that. Former BBC reporter, got to ask you, what are your thoughts on the BBC right now?
Well, look. 1987, the corporation was decapitated by Victor Rothschild. And the reason I say that is because actually in the chairman of the BBC at the time, Marmaduke Hussey's autobiography, is he explains who it was that told him to sack the director general. Now, this was a period of Thatcherism where the BBC was fiercely independent and it was making very critical documentaries and broadcasts on the Thatcher government and on the Irish War. And so Victor Rothschild asked the Director General, Alistair Milne, he asked the chairman of the BBC if he could sack him, and that Marmaduke Hussey, who was the husband to the Queen's chief lady-in-waiting, yes, I can. So that's the point, really, I think, where the BBC started to go downhill. Now it's awful. We had a great time in the late 80s and early 90s doing proper journalism, that is to say, what the people need to hear, in a busy newsroom in London, broadcasting. We were one of the most popular radio stations in London with a whole load of well-known DJs as well. And everyone was listening to us, basically. But the corporation's gone right downhill now until it's basically, if you're listening to most news bulletins, what you're hearing is either a military or corporate press release dressed up as news.
Wow, okay. Not like the old days, for sure. So, do they have a future? I'm not going to get hung up too much on the BBC here, but do you think they have a future?
I think they do, yeah, because the thing is, if a lot of people say, oh, you've got to get rid of the BBC, but no, because you still get some brilliant broadcasts on there. We have, every week, we have Choral Evensong from one of the big cathedrals in Britain, which is a beautiful thing to listen to. You don't get that on any of the commercial stations.
Right.
Plus, you do get quite a lot of good documentaries that you don't get anywhere else. There was a brilliant one on eugenics by a disabled journalist recently, which is a two-parter. And it's really good to see someone who's disabled quizzing these people about, oh, yeah, so you think I should never have been born. Yeah, okay. So
tough question.
They do some good stuff. You know, they do some brilliant stuff. They also broadcast things like the Cold Case Hammarskjöld documentary, which was made by Swedish TV. And that's all about how the destruction, really, of the United Nations with the assassination of Dag Hammarskjöld and how far-right white supremacists in South Africa were behind it. So the BBC still do some good stuff, of course. But, I mean, if they weren't there, these commercial stations would be even worse. The Murdoch stations, et cetera, would be far more right-wing, I think. So there is a sort of rather flaky backstop these days. And obviously they're good. The news bulletins are pretty good, actually. But, you know, there is nowhere else that's reaching so many people that's got so much info, even though, of course, it's mostly propagandistic.
So many things to talk about. I want to just ask you about a few current stories that we've been talking about here. The detaining of Telegram CEO Pavel Durov in France. What do you make of that?
Okay, so this is massive, really. It's like the detaining your editor of the main TV channel in New Zealand So many people now communicate via Telegram because it's one of the least censored and the most tech savvy. It's very good at, you know, you can download, share stuff very easily on there. And it's pretty much uncensored. This is an enormous story. The question is why exactly? And you don't have to look too far back at him. I mean, he was arrested on Saturday as he landed in France in his private jet. And if you go back to Wednesday, you'll find there was a big hoo-ha. The Israelis were complaining that Telegram was sharing information about leaked information, hacked information, they believed, about personal details of people in the Israeli Justice Department. And so this went round the Middle East particularly. It wasn't really in this part of the world much. Certainly, I don't know if it was in down where you are, but it was a big story. And then we find 2 days later, suddenly, Durov is arrested. Now, there are all sorts of charges against him. So, for example, peddling pornography, is actually even terrorism charges. Look, if someone posts a nutty thing on your channel, it's really, I mean, I have my own Telegram channel. You just delete it or whatever, but you can't have a post-moderated system where you have to go through everything before you delete something because you don't think it's appropriate. So it's a really good free speech channel. Obviously, the authorities have decided that he's, and it would be interesting to see if he manages to get out of jail, because it's clear that the Western, particularly through the Ukraine war, etc., the Western governments have been trying to get the Telegram censoring channels, and they've pushed back and they said, well, actually, this doesn't go against our standards of service. But the other main thing is the backdoor. So anyone that knows anything about cybersecurity, the intelligence services demand a backdoor to things like Facebook, to WhatsApp, all these sorts of things. And that doesn't mean to say they can read everything, but it means that they can say, right, we want to have a good old look at this channel. And then the company has to open it up to the intelligence services. Telegram have refused to do that. So I think that's actually at the back of what's the problem here, is that they're refusing to allow the intelligence services to get into their... In here in Britain, it's the GCHQ. In the US, it's the NSA, to get into their servers so that they can monitor channels secretly. And so that's probably why Durov's been arrested. And this is, of course, for most journalists now, certainly the most switched-on journalists, Telegram is the number one way to get hold of your stories, the hold of your news, because it's so uncensored. And, you know, I see quite a lot of stuff on there. I think this is rubbish. This is maybe pernicious, but, you know, I'll just discard that. But that's my job as a journalist, to go through stuff and weed out the rubbish and present some of the facts.
So if he or they agreed to opening up the back door, he'd be, what, back in the corporate jet on his way, do you think?
Quite possibly. Look, it's impossible to know exactly what the discussions are going on in France at the moment. It may even be that he is released at some point soon. But, you know, what's happened is everyone has been herded onto Telegram. You know, this is what's happened. You know, hundreds of thousands, millions, probably billions of users of Telegram. And so this one guy is the key that the intelligence services need in order to get in there. And so it might well be that they're not going to let him out until he says, just he hands over those keys. So ever so difficult to predict what's going to happen. But all I say is it's by far number one story in the world. I have even some journalists, you know, in the UK who are corporate journalists saying, oh, nothing, there's nothing to see here. This isn't an interesting... Yes, it is, because everybody who's really switched on is getting their info through Telegram. So I think, is it called DDO Secrets, Distributed Denial of Secrets, which is a channel which has only just recently been shut down, which was sharing some of this. So you know, these Israeli hacks... and in a way, what's going on is the sharing of hacks and leaks. This is what WikiLeaks were doing, yeah? So now it's on Telegram. It's gone somewhere else. It's found another way. This is one of the things I love about the internet. If you look at the origins of it, it was a communication system as a defense in nuclear war. And the whole principle was that if a communications center gets hit by a nuclear bomb, it's going to be a problem, because how are you going to communicate? Well, the internet was designed so that it would be a network distributed system, so that the network would detect damage and route round it. Well, that's actually what the internet does. So whenever someone censors something, the internet detects it as damage and finds another way around. And that's why we've got the WikiLeaks type material being distributed now on Telegram.
So it's working as designed, as advertised, still, as what you're saying there. What about the arrest of Richard Medhurst? Is that something that we should be thinking about?
Oh, yeah, of course. He's one of the best journalists in the world. He's a freelancer on mostly on Israel-Palestine. And he's extremely knowledgeable in the area. He's lived in, he's been brought up in families that have been diplomatic families, very much like someone like Scott Ritter. He compares them himself. You know, these people have been brought up in UN circles, diplomatic circles. So they're some of the best people there are out there. Someone like maybe Craig Murray, the former ambassador to Uzbekistan. You know, these people are the best people to analyze this because they know that world. They know the world of diplomacy. They know how to stop wars. You know, these are the sort of people that know how to look for problems in diplomacy and to try and fix them and sort them. These are the kind of people we need. So the arresting him is really a pathetic gesture by the British police at Heathrow Airport. It's just trying to intimidate the guy. He's not done anything wrong. I think that what they've said he has been doing is supporting a proscribed organization known as Hamas. Now, it's bizarre to me that Hamas is proscribed. Actually, Hamas is doing very, very well out of this conflict in that it's getting more and more people in Palestine joining it. This was, I think, about 3 weeks ago, one of the reports was saying that they've got something like four times more people trying to join as fighters for Hamas now. This is exactly, by the way, what happened in Northern Ireland when the IRA were being under attack, and the Catholic community, the Republican community, the nationalist community in Northern Ireland were under attack. The IRA had queues out down the road to people to join them. And this is obviously what's happened over in Palestine too. So the idea that Hamas is proscribed, but the Israeli Defense Force is not. Hang on, who is committing a genocide here? As far as I'm concerned, you should be proscribing the genocidalists, not the people who are being subjected to the genocide. It's not an equal fight. It's a massacre in Gaza, and it's carrying on. Well, we could go into that, why it's just carrying on and on and on with no actual specific objective coming anywhere in sight. The other thing that Netanyahu is trying to do in Gaza is to, as well as eliminate Hamas, which is a total failure, it's growing and growing, is to get the hostages back. Well, instead, he's killing them. He's not getting them back. So the whole military operation is a complete irrational failure and needs to come to an end right now. But Netanyahu won't do that because that will almost certainly be the end of his political career. He'll probably have to go to prison. So the whole thing has just become about his political survival and tens of thousands of people dying in the process, so innocent civilians.
And the UK government's happy to work on behalf of Netanyahu and Israel, given that this journalist was stopped at Heathrow.
Well, isn't it weird? You know, what's in it for us? You know, this is what I want to know. What's in it for us? There doesn't seem to be anything in it for the British establishment at all supporting this. But you see, there is a very powerful Israel lobby here. And of course, there are many people who were Brits who were involved in setting up the State of Israel in the first place. You know, so you've got this whole, back in the 1940s, and have been big supporters ever since. So you can call it British Israelism, the Zionist lobby here. Ilan Pappe, by the way, I don't know if you've come across him, has come up with a brilliant book about the Israel lobby, both sides of the Atlantic, the last couple of months launched. There's a very good interview which we did used on our show on Friday, which is from Middle East Eye with Ilan Pappe explaining the fine details of how this Israel lobby works in the UK at our universities with our MPs in our press and the history of it. So that's the reason why I think it's because the Israel lobby is so strong here in Britain in these elite institutions. But it's not really got a leg to stand on. It's just managed to place some of its people in these key elite institutions like the media, government, academia, in order to further Israel's goals.
Let's get on to the UK. How long has Starmer been there now? Well, coming up 45, 50 days, something like that. We know the proportion of vote that he got and the low turnout. Are you seeing what you thought you would see from his leadership, government? And was that predictable? Or do you have other thoughts on the state of your country right now? Because from outside, it looks like it's kind of going to the dogs. That might be over the top, but it's not what from the mother country, is what I would say from down here.
No, you're absolutely right. Well, I mean, listen, we're a dead and dying empire, really. I mean, you know, we've got this major problem in the West called finance capitalism, which it means that money can buy political parties, it can buy up the press, it can buy up regulators, it buys absolutely anything, even, you know, through the arms lobby, etc., wars. So finance capitalism is a major problem. What it does is it just swamps all of those democratic checks and balances. Whereas what we used to have, and what they do have in many parts of the world still, such as Russia, is industrial capitalism, where you've got a reasonably strong government that's a pretty tight regulator. You make it clear as a government that the mafia can do what they want, organized crime can do whatever they want, but they don't come anywhere near the Kremlin, or they don't come anywhere near government. And if they do, they get their legs chopped off, right, by the government. So the organized crime gets that message, you know what I mean? Especially if you take out some of the and jail some of the top organized criminals. But here, you know, that doesn't happen. So I think much of what's going on in the world, particularly this Ukraine conflict, is really a battle between different systems of economics. So you've got a strong government that actually takes, it's a strong government because it takes the reins off, it regulates the population. But for example, you've got something like, I think, isn't it 70% home ownership in Russia. Here, the amount is going down and down. In fact, it's plummeting. At the moment, it's back down to 1870s. Start heading that back down to 1870s levels. So in other words, your income is not going to buy you a house anymore here. In fact, it's getting to the point where it's, you know, it's going to take you probably, you know, 15 years to get a house just from your annual income. And as that's happening, what's really going on is your economy's failed. So in other words, you can't compete with China or anywhere else. And so all of the profits are being made from infrastructure, things like gas, electricity, water. This is where the money's being made by big companies in just literally sweating the infrastructure. And so you end up with a rentier economy, and that's what we've got. So you're right, it is going down. But how's Starmer getting on? Well, he's exactly what we expected. He's about to do a big speech tomorrow, apparently, all about, things are going to get worse before they get better. Well, do something about it then. You know, it's very simple. They could very, very easily just print money, and they could give that to the poorest people on benefits and things like that, which would start to kickstart the economy. That was one of the Corbyn ideas when he was around. But they make out that it's impossible to do anything, you know. So he's really just an apologist for a bunch of kleptocrats in the City of London who are now actually running the country, not even very much from behind the scenes. Rishi Sunak was Goldman Sachs, you know, so he was right out front and in front of everybody explaining who's really in charge. It's these massive financial institutions, the private equity firms, you know, the BlackRocks and the Vanguards. These are the guys who are really calling the shots.
So the population is getting that, is it? They sense that this is where it's heading. And obviously, you're talking about the two systems, you know, Russia compared to, you know, the industrialized sort of economy compared to the financial economy. The financial economy knows that the industrialized version is a real threat to their existence.
Yeah, but I don't think the people get it really. Most people are fed this. Yeah, I don't think so here. I mean, most people understand, oh dear, the government's rubbish, you know, but they don't get that they're being fed all this stuff about, oh, Putin's terrible, Russia's terrible, we're going to have a war with them, are you going to sign up tomorrow, please? You know, all this kind of stuff. As usual, when you've got a crisis in your own domestic situation. It's always someone foreign that has to be blamed for it. And so I think a lot of people are still just getting on, carrying on, because we're not getting any real proper analysis in our mainstream press. I mean, for example, one of my bugbears is this whole concept of accelerationism, which has been promulgated by an old school friend of mine who's now in Shanghai, Nick Land. He's a Nietzschean philosopher, and he's the father of accelerationism. This concept is a philosophical thing which has been taken up by the elite, many of the elite, people like Peter Thiel, Yuval Noah Harari, and people like this. The idea is what you do is you have this ridiculous kind of dream in the future, the technocracy, human 2.0. And what you do is you sell this as an idea. Elon Musk is into all this stuff too. For example, the electric car. It looks to me now as if the whole electric car, electric vehicle thing is collapsing. In Germany, the sales are down this year, 40%. Musk has just taken $50 billion out of Tesla. He's cutting and running while everyone else is still on the bandwagon. And accelerationism, in a nutshell, is that you create these various crises. COVID is a good example. Climate's another one. But the solution you come up with is going to make things worse. It's not going to be a solution. So with COVID, it's the jabs, it's the World Health Organization getting more power, not less power. With the climate crisis, it's a zero carbon agenda. You want to get rid of all of your reliable old-fashioned sources of power. You've got to rely on nuclear. Oh, how green that is. What we're doing here in Britain is we're now chewing up forests and feeding them into the power stations. Now, that's being sold as green. So the idea is you create a crisis. There's loads of examples of this in farming. Almost every crisis, you get the migrant crisis, everything. And what you do is you have a policy which is dressed up to sort the crisis out, but it's not. It's making it worse. And that's why we're losing faith in much of our politics. The people who are laughing in the background, of course, are the private equity firms, and they're the fascists who are getting ready to take over when the system collapses.
Oh, dear. I want to talk about, get your views on, Ukraine. You mentioned Ukraine before. The Kursk incursion. What do you think's going on there? Because surely there's no way up against a country as big, as powerful, as populated and industrially, I guess, set up as Russia, that you're never going to really make even a dent. And meantime, we hear that on all fronts in the Ukraine war that there's been a horrible loss of life. The Russians are operating integrated air defense and on-the-ground systems that seem to be working very well. Obviously, in mainstream media reporting, you don't hear that. But what do you think the end game could be there? And how far off is it, do you think?
Well, look, first of all, the Kursk operation was mainly British. The Russians know all this. A lot of the technology used. Scott Ritter has been very good on this. If you go and have a look at his, I think it's, is NATO going to, is will Russia hit NATO, retaliate against NATO? Something like that was one of his recent things. And his analysis is excellent, and he points out that the actual attack itself has been so well coordinated. I mean, it's almost like, the Russians know they're fighting NATO because they've got satellite help from the NATO countries. They've got all the most modern tech, war fighting tech. So they're able to detect where there may be troops about to be up ahead and then go around them. So this was a very slick operation. But the Russians, I think the Russians knew it was coming. I think they knew it was coming and they were quite happy for it to come, because what it does is it is taking a lot of troops away from the other front lines in the country. And it's meant that the Russians are pushing forward in other places, the oblasts that they want in southeast, in the Donbass region. It's being much easier for them to take those while this is going on. And of course, the inevitable's happened with all these snazzy gas guzzling. They're not Chieftain tanks, are they? There's something else, the British tanks that they've been using. That was when I was a kid, they were Chieftains anyway. Yeah, now it's the Challenger, I think, that they use.
Challenger, right.
They're real gas guzzlers, and they've run out of gas. So they have to sit around thinking, right, well, we can't really just go down the road. We're going to have to stay here for a while. We'll stick the tank into a tree line and hope for the best here. So they are probably, they're going to have real problems retreating if they wish to retreat. They've got real problems with the supply line because the Russians are, have their eye on that the whole time. They might allow some more in. They will have problems, probably having problems with ammunition, keeping going. And so the Russians are quite happy, it seems, for them to stay where they are for a while and exhaust themselves. And then, so from a military point of view, it seems to be done mainly for Western PR. So the Western countries can say, oh, look, the Ukrainians are really fighting back here. The Russians are never going to give up the Donbass because it's a Russian-speaking area. It was only in the last end of the 20th century that this piece of land was given to Ukraine. It was always Russian Crimea around that area. And it was the industrial heartland of Russia, actually, the Donbass, sort of a bit like our Sheffield and Manchester, big cities like that, producing so much industry, steel working, this sort of thing. And so they're not going to give that area back to the Ukrainians, whatever happens. But what is happening, of course, there is the West is getting a chance to try out all its new tech, all its new kit against the Russians, with the thought towards a potential Third World War, where they might have to use it in anger against the Russians in Europe. So the other major problem is we're not getting any of this Russian gas, the Nord Stream pipeline gas. And so this means we have to buy all our kit, all our gas from LPG, the liquid gas from the United States. The Americans are doing very well out of this. So, you know, there's a whole thing in Ukraine where the Americans are doing rather nicely and the Europeans seem to be almost committing economic suicide for the benefit of the Americans. I don't know. I think most of the Eastern European countries, like Hungary, for example, have got real great trepidation about the idea of trying to take on Russia, particularly when Putin has got such massive support. You talk to any Russian, they think the guy's brilliant. Because what he's done very cleverly is he's been very, very slow. For example, 8 years of shelling in the Donbass of Russian people, and he didn't do anything. So everyone in Russia is saying, come on, you've got to help these people. And because he took so long, he's managed to bring not only the hawks in Russia with him, but also many of the more pacifist-minded Russians with him. That's why he's got so much support, far more than any of our Western leaders seem to have.
Okay, and how long do you think, you don't have to answer this, or maybe it's how long is a piece of string kind of question, but this can't go on for too much longer, this whole thing, can it?
Yeah, it can. So I would defer to Mark Sloboda. If anyone has got a pen handy, scribble his name down, Mark Sloboda. He's a former nuclear officer in the US Army, I don't know if it's Strategic Air Command. Anyway, he was involved in the nuclear program in the US military. He's now teaching at Moscow State University. And when I spoke to him about it, he said, no, it's never going to end this. This is going on and on.
Oh, God.
It's one of those forever wars. And, of course, Boris Johnson made sure of that when there was peace talks back in April 22, when they were about to sign the peace that Zelensky had got elected to do. And Boris Johnson went over and said, no, don't sign the peace. And by the way, I'm not sure Boris said this to him, but Zelensky was threatened with his life as well. So if you do make peace, then you're going to be a dead man. It's been a really nasty game in Ukraine. I think it will carry on. And I don't see this conflict ending. The arms companies are doing too well out of it. The private equity firms, the shareholders in those arms companies, it's one of the only places where the West can make money anymore. They're not making any money competing with on the international markets with their products. Really very little. So, I think there's a certain inevitability about this just carrying on. The two systems are at war with each other there. You know, the finance capitalism versus industrial capitalism. It's Michael Hudson's book, I think, is Michael, I don't know if you know him. He's an economist, has written a book, The Evolution or the Destiny of Civilization, I think it's called. Finance capitalism, industrial capitalism or socialism. But anyway, his analysis of all of this is some of the best you'll find anywhere in the world. He's a US guy, teaches in Chinese universities, and he's very articulate. It makes economics really easy to understand, which 90% in my experience of economics, economists do the opposite. They're trying to obfuscate. It's like a dark art, you know, but he really helps explain why. You know, different. If a country has got a similar economic model, in other words, that they actually have elected politicians who do what the people want and serve the people, rather than just financial people running everything, then they tend to get on very well. And they don't like people that do things differently. And that's, I think, at the root of this conflict. Until that goes away, it's probably going to carry on.
But wouldn't Putin just say, okay, enough of this now? We're putting a line under this. You've got all the support that you talked about before. Can't lose here on that front. We've got the weaponry. Let's end it.
Well, yeah, but I don't think he... You see, like I say, he wants to carry the people with him, doesn't he?
Okay.
And for him to escalate, this is... the only way I think you can succeed as a leader is to be showing that the other side is doing the escalation. Very much like in the Middle East, you know, you've got these decapitations going on where the Israelis bumping off with missiles the leaders of Hezbollah or Hamas or whoever. We've seen bombs placed in the Iranian parliament in the past with tens of numbers of the Iranian government being blown up, but it doesn't change anything because it doesn't change the system. And the way these very mature, I think, democracies cope is they say, well, actually, a nurse on the front line in a war or a soldier is just as valuable as one of our leaders. And just because we know them and they're our leaders, we're not going to overreact. You know, we consider that you're not going to change our policy by killing a few of our leaders because, you know, the people below them are pretty much aligned because we've all talked this all through and we agree this is what we need to do. So, it seems to me that that both in the Middle East and in the Ukraine conflict, the West is making all the running. You know, so, for example, we've had this report of all the power being taken out in Ukraine last night by, well, it's been all over the news here, but what they don't say is that the previous evening there were a whole load of strikes, I think it's 20 or so, right across Russia, up to 1,000 miles into Russia by the Ukrainians. And so the response by the Russians to take out the Ukrainian electricity this morning or yesterday is a reaction, but you don't get what it's a reaction. They never tell you on the news here what it's a reaction to. This is the trick. So you're made to think, without them telling you, you're made to think that this is just out of the blue. The Russians have done this, aren't they cruel? You know, but of course it's not. And I always remember a guy I knew who was a Danish journalist telling us about a friend of his who was on Danish TV. He was a long-time news presenter on the television, and he retired in the 1990s. And his last night on TV doing the Danish news, obviously not in English, but in Danish, he put his arms on the news desk like this, and he said, "And that is what we decided to tell you tonight."
Yeah, I think I saw that now that you've reminded me. Yeah, wow, okay. Nothing it's to lose, great, you know, last shift, right?
Yeah, but it's what they don't tell you. That's what you need to know. And that's what we try and do every week. I'm sure it's what you're trying to do. There's loads of stuff that they're trying to not tell you about. For example, you know, the Mike Lynch and this boat that went down in Sicily. Well, yeah. Isn't it funny? You know, this guy's company is a high-tech company linked to intelligence services. He's got a very, very brilliant piece of cybersecurity software that he's been peddling for years, which was developed with the help of one of the former MI5 people in Britain here, made an absolute fortune selling his stuff to the intelligence services, which is Hewlett-Packard, by the way. And then they took him to court for 12 years. They lost because they didn't have a leg to stand on. And so suddenly he has a nasty accident, and his mate as well, Stephen Chamberlain, who's his business partner, who was also in this case for 12 years fighting it, he's accidentally run over in Cambridge whilst out jogging 2 days before. Now, this is no doubt in my mind at all. This is an intelligence hit of some sort. But they haven't said that. There's a lot of coverage of it. This is the way I think the mainstream journalists deal with this inability to tell the public, is that they'll give it a lot of coverage, but they won't be able to say this is quite obviously some sort of assassination here that's happened, most likely to do with it. The thing is, again, very much like Paul Durov, the intelligence services always want backdoors into this software, and it might be just as simple as Mike Lynch refused to give them a backdoor into the software. And of course, as soon as he does that, he's compromising the security of it. And the reason that he's so successful is he's got a damn fine bit of security software. He doesn't want to compromise it and throw away all the value of his business, quite rightly, but he's paid the price, it looks like to me.
And there's a Kiwi connection there. I think the captain of the super yacht is a Kiwi, and I'm just reading a headline here from the last day or so. James Field is his name, reportedly grilled by Italian police. So what do you think might happen to James Cutfield in this?
Well, I mean, okay, so let's just look at the scenario. Why is it the captain's fault that the thing is, if it's a storm that's blown it over? Look, the fall guy, they have to have a fall guy. There has to be somebody to scapegoat for whatever's happened with this ship. And it's also interesting, isn't it? They had the president of one of the big banks, was it Morgan Stanley, on the ship at the same time, discussing deals to do with, you know, refinancing his business or whatever. So, yeah, I mean, I would say James Cutfield's probably totally innocent of everything, but they've got to have somebody to hang out in front of the public and say, oh, look at this terrible guy. Wasn't he awful? I mean, basic things like that the ship wasn't told that this storm was in, and most of the ships were told, and so had come in to the port, to into the shelter of the port. So it was actually quite a way out. Various things that are very suspicious, so such as these people were all seem to be locked into the ship somehow. They couldn't get out, you know. So who locked them in? Why couldn't they get out?
Yeah, they were in one cabin, right?
I mean, from what little we know from this distance, you know what I mean, in the ship in Sicily and the various to do with the stories, the circumstances around it should make you immediately megally suspicious. God, look at the amount of money involved here. Wasn't it, from memory, I think it was 20 billion Hewlett-Packard paid for his. So he was a very, very wealthy man, but he didn't want to be pushed around. You know, he's not going to be pushed around by the spooks. That's the people who seem to be running the show most of the time nowadays, especially you see in the run-up to a potential Third World War. These people, they want to have absolute control of the communications and of the cyber warfare. They don't want anyone having really good cyber security, of course, you know. So this guy, you know, I don't know any of the details. All I'm saying is, to me, that's exactly what it looked. You know, do you remember the Trump thing, for example, when Musk interviewed Trump recently? They had some sort of denial of service attack on there. And so they had to delay it 20 minutes or something before it started. But, you know, you look at that and you think, well, this is Trump's opponents, isn't it? You know, this is, and they're in with the spooks. So Trump is saying he wants to take down the deep state. You know, the deep state took him down while he was on his interview. So this is the cyber war. And I don't know if any of your listeners or viewers have seen, read William Gibson. This is cyberpunk era we're living in here. Because this cyber warfare is, you know, it's just another type. It's psychological warfare. It's cyber warfare. It's economic warfare. It's not just fighting on the ground anymore. There's all this kind of multipolar, not a multipolar world, but it's, you know, I think they call it fourth generation warfare.
Yeah,
loads of stuff going on. And cyber is very, very important. They need to be able to control the internet. Of course they do.
I want to loop back to the UK before we finish our chat, but just one more on what we've just been talking about. You were talking about forever wars, and I got the impression what you're saying that, you know, the Ukraine conflict, or the conflict with Russia and NATO and wider than that, potentially is a forever war. Middle East is a forever war. Then you mentioned potential for World War III. So we ask many commentators and guests when we're talking in this area on this program, because we all want to know, you know, what do you think the chances are of a sort of like epic World War level conflict at some point? What do you think the chances of that are?
Well, I mean, there's been quite a lot of talk, haven't there, about doomsday and Armageddon in the Middle East. I mean, this does seem to me to be the far-right Zionist government in Israel, their final gambit, really. I mean, they seem to have decided that they're going to just carry on and slaughtering as many people in Gaza as is necessary to destroy Hamas, which will actually just make Hamas stronger. And the people, and it's not just Hamas, it's the ideas behind, you know, people who want to get involved in that battle and support the Palestinians in whatever way they can. I mean, this has been going on a long, long time. But the real danger in the Middle East is to do with religious aspects, I think. And this is something that people quite often miss, is the real conflict down there is Zionism, which is this kind of very bizarre version of Judaism, which I'm not sure has got anything really to do with the proper Old Testament Jews, you know, the Orthodox Judaism. It's much more to do with land grabbing and power, and it's almost like the holy real estate owners, you know, landlords or whatever, and not much to do with God, really. And so, and Islam. So there's this massive kind of battle, which was talked about by Albert Pike back in the 1870s. But I mean, whether what he said was correct about, you know, having this epic battle, I'm not so sure. But you can see what's going on now. You've already got the Russians in that part of the world, in Syria, for example. The United States is absolutely ready to jump in and help the Israelis at any point. They've even got their aircraft carriers and stuff now sailing in. And so if this does spark off, you know, you've got the Chinese as well in the background as big supporters of the Palestinians, although they're not really doing much at the UN Security Council. So you've got a potential spark there, most definitely, for a much wider war if things really do kick off between the Islamic world and the Persian world in the Middle East and the Zionists and the United States and possibly Britain too, helping them out through Akrotiri in Cyprus, as we seem to be doing all the time, with special forces and by flying jets to help them. And that's worrying, isn't it? I mean, but the main focus there is in Jerusalem at the Al-Aqsa Mosque and the Third Temple, because the Israelis have got a massive Third Temple far-right movement that want to rebuild the temple, that is to demolish the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Now, this, of course, is going to inflame the hearts and minds of all the Muslims around that part of the world and all over the world if they see their mosque demolished. So I think that's what they're planning, to actually do that in order to provoke. And it seems to me that's much of what the Israelis are doing, is provoke by attacking, by killing, for example, the chief negotiator of Hamas. You know, this is a massive provocation. And if that happens, you're going to get a war, obviously, that's blamed on Muslims and Jews and all the Abrahamic faith. So that's it seems to me is the plan. I mean, looking ahead, I mean, it seems almost that we're moving towards this. We can't kind of turn back from it because of the economic failures in the West. They've got nothing else to turn to but war to make money, you know. So you've got two things that will come out of that, I think, out of that war. It's like the shock doctrine in Naomi Klein. The idea is you have a massive war, and then you get your way after the war. You've got your plans all ready for after the war. So you've got the CBDCs, the central bank digital currencies and programmable money, which is a new financial system for the world, to replace the Bretton Woods system, which has pretty much failed. The IMF and the World Bank, it's been a complete, and the petrodollar, a complete dead loss, as it's been totally abused. And also a kind of new age religion. So if you can blame the war on the Abrahamic faiths, you know, the Jews, the Christians, and the Muslims, what a bunch of loonies, they've taken us to war again, then a kind of man-made religion to be brought in at the same time. Yeah. So I think that's their end game. Whether or not they get away with it, of course they won't. You know, there's no way the world is going to fall for that. You know, many people will, but I think, you know, we've been used to seeing these sorts of evil that's going on in Gaza in the past. You know, we saw it in the Second World War with Adolf Hitler, and we saw it with the the destruction of the Jews, much in a similar way. Actually, you know, that many Muslims have been targeted. Look at the rapes and everything that's going on in the prisons in Israel now of thousands of Palestinians without trial. stuck in prison and treated horrifically, some of them killed in jail. Terrible wounds being seen by medical doctors, etc., and deaths of people in custody by, you know, mistreated by the Israelis. This is evil incarnate, is what's going on. And so that's my prescription. But, you know, as Catherine Austin Fitz says, I don't know if you know her, she's very good an analyst in the States and has been very close to government in the past. She said it's a war on God, but God's going to win.
Yeah.
And she's absolutely right, because the more they try and push this, the more they're going to realize, oh, no, we're on a hiding to nothing. Well, I don't think they care anymore. I just think they want to make money and get power, and they're going to have a massive power grab, and they're going to fail. So that's my, you know, I suppose a fairly positive out of all the, you know, God looking wins. At it, you've got to try and be positive. You also got to try and be realistic. I think things are going to get, like Starmer is about to say tomorrow, worse before they get better. Yep. The thing is, just don't be disheartened. As I say on my show every week, don't let the satanic banksters get you down, because a lot of this is about morale, you know. Yep. Keep going and keep cheerful. And if you're having a difficult time, chin up.
Keep calm, carry on. Just to wind up, back to the UK, I'm just wondering what you think about this, because there is a division, it seems anyway, or maybe there's not, between... I guess the populations that have been coming into the UK over time. I'm thinking particularly of the Islamist populations. And, of course, the native Brits. And obviously there's been some terrible violence, and we know kind of what we're talking about there. Mm. How do you see that one playing out? Is that going to just be ongoing division on division on division? At some point something gives? How do you see that one proceeding?
Oh, well, I mean, I can really only talk about Bristol, where I live. We have a very, very strong anti-fascist movement here. For example, the anti-fascist demonstrators, peaceful, massively outnumbered the police as well as the far right when they had a demo here. Look, I don't think there's very much stomach for this far-right stuff, to be honest with you. I think most Brits are just... And it's not anything to do with Islam or Islamists. It's the general problem with migrants is nothing to do with religion. It's just about importing cheap labour because, for example, our care sector has failed. Elderly care has completely failed. The way that, you know, if they were to pay proper wages, these care homes, they would have to close because they couldn't afford to carry on. So they have to have all these care visas to bring tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people in to work in care homes and bring their families as well. So the it's a structural problem. And I think most Brits actually genuinely understand that. They know that they're being, the idea is to sort of get white people fighting black people, and they're not up for it. Do you know what I mean? I think we've seen this for so many years here in Britain with attempts to kind of weaponize migration. It's not the migrant's fault. You know, the migrant might have taken your job. You know, yes, you're going to get annoyed about that, but it's not their fault. It's the fault of the people that are bringing them in. And that's organized crime, and it's our own political leaders and our own financial elite that are bringing them in. So I do think, you know, if you want a bit of a positive note, most people in the UK are not up for some kind of, you know, poor white people versus poor black people race war. And also, very interesting to hear Nick Griffin from the British National Party. He was ousted from the British National Party in the late noughties, around about 2010. And he's been absolutely upfront saying, well, we got approached in 2008 by big American funders saying, look, we will give you loads of money to boost your political party if you concentrate on hating Muslims and stop criticizing the financial system. Those were the two things that they had to do to get the money. He refused, and he got booted out of the British National Party. And at the same time, you're saying exactly the same time, the English Defence League was set up and Tommy Robinson and his lot started, and they were massively funded. So there's been a weaponization of the British nationalist political parties to make them Islamophobic. So the idea, of course, is that, and now where is Tommy Robinson? He's over in Israel. And he's been in Cyprus, staying in Cyprus. His links to the Israel lobby are very, very well documented. So It looks to me basically as if much of the politics in Britain has failed to challenge these massive rallies. 250,000 people, 500,000 people turning out in London in support of the Palestinians. The attempt to overturn that, to make, you know, by the pro-Israel lobby, has been a total failure. So what have they done? They've weaponized the far right, and they've got them out on the streets through people like Tommy Robinson, getting them to try and turn it into some anti-Muslim thing. And that's kind of only gone off half cock anyway, you know. So I think they're at the end of the road when they're trying to get the British public to sort of have a go at Muslims, because we're not going to do that. We're not like that. We're actually really not like that. We're not gonna have some sort of race war here. It ain't gonna happen. You might be able to do it somewhere else, but not here.
It's been fascinating chatting with you, Tony Gosling, independent journalist from the UK. And if you're interested, you can listen to Tony at Not the BCFM Politics Show on Apple Podcasts. Thank you for giving us the time, Tony, and maybe we'll chat again sometime.
Yeah, I hope so. Yeah, the website's thisweek.org.uk.
Good.
And my book, look, this is my book. Called The Traitors of Arnhem. And this is all about the links between the British, and a lot of people know about Operation Paperclip, the CIA and the Nazis.
Yeah, know about that.
What people don't know about is this guy called Desmond Morton, who is Winston Churchill's private secretary. He was very closely in contact in a year before the end of the war with Martin Bormann, who was Hitler's private secretary.
Yep.
And these are the deals that were done in order to really give safe passage to a lot of Nazis at the end of the war, and also to exchange of technology. But above all, the British slowed the end of the war down to give the Nazis a bit of extra time.
Interesting.
At the Battle of Arnhem, which was deliberately nobbled. The Nazis needed extra time to squirrel their wealth away. And this is about a Fourth Reich. So that's what we're dealing with today, I think, a financial Fourth Reich built on Nazi money from after World War II. And that's kind of my life's work in a way, because I spent a lot of time studying these people, the Bilderberg conferences and the Bilderberg group. And they were chaired for the first 20 years by a former SS officer, Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands. And that's what got me into the story, and various other people have helped me down the way. But I think we've done a pretty good job in showing that what we're dealing with now is really another kind of Nazi empire, a financial one, a Fourth Reich.
Wow. What a note to end on. Thank you, Tony. Really appreciate the chat. Thank you.
Nice one, Paul. Thank you very much.
The RCR shop has great gift ideas, from great-looking tees, hoodies, caps, tote bags, bumper stickers, and more. The RCR shop is now open at www.realitycheck.radio/shop.